Welcome to the Mad Men Happy Hour, the officially unofficial podcast for Mad Men on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 7, Episode 14. I'm not sure if you're aware of this. It's a series finale.
It's serious.
It is. It's called Person to Person. What did you think of the final episode of Mad Men?
I loved it. I loved it the first time I watched it. I have seen it a total of four times since then. My new career is exclusively watching Mad Men finales.
Okay, and that's a short career, but...
It gave me everything that I wanted. Because remember, my big thing is I want to know that everyone is okay.
Or could be okay? I
might even said could be okay, because that's what I felt like I got. And I got a lot of things I didn't know I wanted. But yeah, I felt like that every single character could be okay. I don't know, and I actually liked the ambiguity they injected. Not in a... cut the black, is my television off, but just those final 10 minutes are so open to interpretation, and it runs the gamut. I've seen people unhappy with the finale. Yeah. I've seen people happy with the finale, but think it's a very cynical, depressing end. I've seen people happy with the finale and think it's uplifting and positive. I'm kind of on that camp, but
I'm a little more really, toward the cynical really liked side it. Myself.
The thing is I... I haven't seen anyone's take where I'm just like, well, you're wrong.
Yeah,
that's stupid.
Sure.
And that's unusual. Like, normally there's one or two people where, like, I might not say that's stupid or wrong, but I like, yeah, you don't got a leg to stand on. I thought everyone had really good points and that no one's wrong, no one's right. I feel really bad for people that didn't like it, though, because I had such a ridiculous smile on my face for most of the episode, except for, you know, dramatically inappropriate times, like...
like Betty dying
Betty
of cancer.
Dying cancer, yeah. The refrigerator man bawling about it being overlooked by his wife and children. Not
big fat smile on your
big,
face.
Big, so satisfied.
I'm really only taking the cynical approach in one character's regard. I think
Don.
The rest of them have fairly positive outcomes, in my opinion, at least in the moment. And I think that's a key determining factor in where I stand, is that in these moments that we see them for the final time, most of these characters are happy.
That's true. And, you know, we've got another week to talk about, you know, this might be something that ages for people that
I think it will be.
You know,
yeah.
You come back and watch it multiple times, you might have a different appreciation. I got at least a couple emails of people initially kind of unsatisfied, but have grown to appreciate it.
Yeah, I kind of felt that on my first watch. I was like, I don't quite get where we leave Don here. Hmm. And then on further viewing, I came to appreciate, you know, how open-ended that is and how you can interpret it in many different ways. And I feel like that is a good season finale or series finale.
It is. It felt I was really high last week, and I remember saying that there's nothing that I think the show can do to disappoint me. I'm a famously easy grader when it comes to Mad Men, but sure. I love the show. I love this the way it wrapped up. I'm really, really happy with it.
Okay. Why don't you tell us who made it?
It was written and directed, as it should be, by Matthew Weiner.
Yeah, not too surprising.
He wanted, just like Villigan before him, he wanted to personally be the one that brought it in for the landing, and I think he stuck it.
Okay.
I think he stuck it.
Well, let's get into the recap. We start off with Don sort of inexplicably driving a Camaro through the salt flats. You know, he has apparently been on the road getting up to stuff over the course of the hiatus here from
getting into
last episode to this one.
Because we decided we were in early August, maybe late July of the previous episode, because they're talking about... I think we were in like late August. Because Sally had gone back to school.
Yeah, either way, there are a couple of months that transpire between the last episode and the end of this one.
Maybe all of September, and we're some point in October, based on the pervasive Halloween decorations we see everywhere.
Yeah, at the beginning. I know at the end we move into November.
Yeah.
Because Jones got her calendar up.
Yep.
But yeah, so he's somehow driving a Camaro on the salt flats. Doesn't really matter how.
I loved his big sweaty face and the helmet. I loved Don and denim.
Don in the denim jacket's yes. pretty good. Yeah,
that's the thing. People said that he's square and like all, but man, I think Don Draper throughout the episode, throughout the series, has embodied the old school cool.
Yeah, like,
Don
Frank Sinatra style.
Don cool. Draper in any outfit that I've seen him in could conceivably walk into some place in the 21st century and no one laugh at him.
Yeah, I'm with you. So he gets back to the garage and he gives him some advice on how to set this land speed record. You know, there could be a shimmy. I felt a little weirdness up at 130.
Yep.
I didn't realize he was this good of a mechanic. Like, he would help these guys set a land speed record.
Yeah.
They seem like dumbasses.
Well, I mean,
because they're like, oh, lands... God, you guys, you know a shitload about this. A shimmy at one.
Yeah. Those
land speed record people need to be really good to set a record.
The thing is, I feel like those land speed records are kind of bogus and that there's so many classifications and like.
Okay.
You set a.
The fastest one in an SS Camaro.
The fastest SS Camaro with. Metallic flake gray paint
and a non-professional driver, like you just have to qualify it so much,
right?
I don't know, it was a little weird to me, but you know, I rolled with it.
Sure.
Just like Don did. Roger's getting his schedule from both of his secretaries, which he's now back to two at this point. And then he sends one of them out of the room and tells Meredith
if you told me in season one that Roger Sterling would be going through secretaries two at a time.
How you thought it would go, right?
No, I would not. I would not have imagined it in that setting.
You would have said, yeah, absolutely.
Hell yeah. Heart attack hadn't slowed him down at all.
Yeah, so he tells Meredith that he's got to let her go because he doesn't need two secretaries.
Mm-hmm.
Which secretary do you pick in that scenario?
Meredith all the way.
I think I am too.
Meredith has put in an MVP season as far as secretaries.
Yeah, if he needs someone to design his interior of his apartment,
right?
Boom.
You have to get
she's
used
more
to
than
her.
A secretary.
You have to realize that you can't just say translate it to Pig Latin and she won't do it. But on the other hand, how cool is it that she's translated his speech into Pig Latin?
Kind of amazing. Yeah.
That's really cool.
So then we go to another.
Relentlessly positive, too. That's the other thing you like about
even when
Meredith.
She's fired.
She's always lands on her feet.
Yeah. So we go to another meeting at McCann, and Peggy is disappointed about being taken off of the Chevalier account. And despite Stan's protest, she goes to do something about it and insists that she have the account.
Yep.
And it works. Yep. She gets it.
Stan's face and reaction to this, like, he doesn't need distress in his life.
No. Stan
although
Stan
he
is
does.
Really
it turns out he does.
Yeah, I mean, it works out for his best interest there, but Stan is really content with what he's doing at this point, you know? I don't feel like he's coasting, but I feel like he's just settled in. He knows where he's at, he knows where he stands, and he likes it.
He's good at his job.
Yeah.
He doesn't need to prove anything.
Sure.
He's got that beard, he can rock an ascot. Yep. What more does he need?
And they set us up a little bit here for Pete leaving the company with his replacement, Stu. Apparently, so was Peggy working for Pete, I guess?
Probably. He was her account man.
Yeah.
Which isn't the same as working with, but they're kind of like a unit, you know? Okay. He's the schmoozer. He takes the requirements from the client and delivers them to the engineers.
I'm a people person, damn it. Right. What the hell is wrong with you people?
Jiminy Christmas. Yeah.
Then we see Don laying in bed with a hooker. Who's trying to steal his wallet, and he calls her out, and he gets his money back and his ring back, and gives her a $20 tip regardless.
What's a 20? I thought it was like a lot of money.
Was it? I thought it was a couple
tens. I guess $20 is a lot of money. That's like...
That's a fair profit.
I don't know what. How much does hooker cost, man?
Well, how much do you have to pay a hooker to sleep with Don Draper?
True.
There's also that.
It's all gravy.
Yeah. $20 is a bonus.
Yeah.
No.
Gravy may be a poor choice of words, but yeah.
I can't tell what the class of this hooker is. Is she high class? Is she low rent? Is she like?
I'd say she's.
He's out kind of in the middle of nowhere.
She's in between.
Like you know, people talk about a Vegas 10 or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't think she's like a high class New York hooker.
She's not a lot lizard.
But
she's not like a high class escort. She's just she's a girl out there hustling.
Yeah,
she's a hustler. Sure.
So I felt like Don maybe could have given her a little more. But whatever.
Well, after he did give her a 20, he did give her a little more.
Oh, God. You're right. He does. So Joan gets
to... Can't forget the gratuity.
It was gratuitous, all right?
It was.
So Joan gets to her hotel room where Richard's waiting with cocaine. Just boom. Here's some cocaine. Let's both try it. And they do.
Just when I thought Richard couldn't get any more 70s, he snorts cocaine off of Joan's fingernail. By God, that man is a magnificent 70s bastard.
Yeah, I love it. He proposes that she move to California where they can spend their lives together or live their lives together. I don't know. It's not quite like a, let's make this a permanent sort of thing.
It's more like, hey, we just tried cocaine and everything seems like a good idea.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Let's just do more of this, you know?
It's like, do you want to get married? Sure. Do we have to get married? Hell no. No, cocaine looks good on them.
And Joan is super happy in these scenes.
Like, I got to say, Joan is off the charts awesome this whole episode. I haven't seen her look this good, be this happy, and be this confident in a long time.
I'm with you.
Since rolled his sweaty walrus body off of her, it's been at least that long since I've seen her this happy and content.
Yeah, Ken understates it when he says, you know, you're looking good.
No, she looks like a million fucking dollars.
Yeah.
It's... And, well, that's probably about what she's worth. So
yeah, I think so.
It's actually appropriate.
So then we go to Pete, not looking so good, but looking pretty happy. He visits Peggy in her office and gives her a cactus, which is a real prick move, I got to say.
It is.
No pun intended.
Yep.
He walks in ready for lunch. Harry walks in ready for lunch because he's always ready. And he complains when Peggy doesn't want to go out with him.
That's redundant. You could have just said Harry walks in.
Yeah, it's lunchtime. Harry walks in. Pete gives him some cookies and pushes him out the door before saying goodbye to Peggy.
Yep. Harry goes out eating a tin of cookies by himself.
Yeah, giving her a lot of support in the process here is Pete.
Ah, super cute.
You know, creative director by 1980, and she's like, that sounds like a really long time, which is a decade.
So I thought this, and I thought I might be crazy, and then I got an email or two that asked me the same question. Did you think that the cactus was a weird stand-in for Pete and Peggy's love child?
No, that thought never crossed my mind.
Like, they're both what about the mean? Same. He's like, he goes, take this, I have a five-year-old, which is about how old their child would be. When she takes it, she holds it right there around her belly. Like it's some kind of prickly seed tearing itself out of her uterus, like only a demonic Pete child could be. I'm adding a little bit of commentary, okay?
No,
I'm
that's the only fair thing I've heard you say.
But no, and he's like, when I come back, it better still be alive. I know there was some people wanting them to kind of talk about that, and I wonder if this was a way that the wiener was playing with their expectations about how they would leave things.
I did not get any of that.
Okay.
But sure.
Well, it's just me and two emailers against the world. They're dukes up.
All right. If you had Lane Price on your side, maybe.
What'd you think about Peggy's octopussy painting with the cat's plaster all over it?
I didn't see that.
At first I just thought she had like catted it up, you know, like made it like feminine and like cute.
Uh-huh.
And then I realized they were all black cat Halloween cats. So it's like that was just a temporary thing.
Okay. Gotcha.
But yeah, no, she put like cardboard cutouts of cats that were like... But putting what it looks like it's like they're like cuddling the octopus's head, it was kind of adorable.
Weird.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, but I thought the cactus was a metaphor for their child. I think Molly Lambert on Grantland picked this up too, but there was a little Slaughterhouse-Five action with them mentioning Harry's, you know, being the Three Musketeers, which is kind of a pejorative thing in that novel because like, there's this character who's a real dumbass that thought everyone else liked him, and he said that they were the Three Musketeers, and then the first chance they got, they dumped them and abandoned them to the Germans, and he got slaughtered.
They would totally do that with Harry.
Nah, I think Harry, he was eating the tin of cookies. Pete took so long. He called for the elevator. The elevator opened. It was just a shaft.
But he
was face deep into that tin, and he fell 50 floors to his death.
I love it.
That's the end of Harry Crane.
That's how I choose to remember Harry Crane.
Yep.
Perfect. We go to Don, who's on the phone with Sally, and Sally is kind of trying to avoid telling him about Betty's cancer, or playing coy. Like, she's she's doing something weird here until she finally tells him about it.
She's Bettying him.
Yeah.
There's, again,
you're right.
I think it's interesting how well Kierna does a good mix of Don and Betty isms. Mm-hmm. And like here on the phone, she's kind of very much Betty. But then later on in the season or the episode, rather, when Bobby's cautioning her that her mom won't like her not going to Madrid, she like rocks a Don troll face.
Uh-huh.
As her only response. So it's like, it's really spooky how well she does with this stuff.
Yeah, I thought it was great. She, you know, she tells Don about it. Don says he's coming home. And instead she says, no, actually, I'd like you to make sure that the kids stay with Henry because that's what they need. That kind of gets dropped. I mean, does that get dropped because of the conversation that Betty and Don have later on?
Well, it's interesting because what Sally was saying was, I want you to fight Mom on the custody, but I want him to stay with Henry. I don't want him to go off with Uncle Bill.
Yeah.
And that all makes sense. And then,
but it just gets dropped. Don never brings it up to Betty.
Yeah. I mean, he tries. I mean, obviously he's not swayed by Sally's argument. But the biggest surprise for me is as soon as Sally said this, I would have thought that my reaction would be outrage. No, Don needs to be there for his kids. But
yeah.
My reaction was, that's about right.
Uh-huh.
Don does not deserve to have sole custody of these children. My best case scenario is he works out something to where if he can see his children every weekend for a year, then he can get like expanded custody. But I think it would be a very bad idea to just give these kids him in a moment of grief. I mean, he thinks he can do that, but he hasn't really, and maybe he can, but he hasn't demonstrated it. So
certainly.
One of my criteria for success is Don is there for his kids at the end, and he wasn't, but it didn't seem very negative because again, I got a very strong opinion by watching Bobby and Sally interacting that these kids are going to be okay.
Yeah, I was really in the same boat.
And I'm hoping that Don, you know, my positive take on this is Don hits this moment of low, and this is the time where he is going to finally change and be a better person. I've got some evidence that suggests that I think that's what the Wiener is trying to tell us happened. But it made sense to me that this isn't something that Don wanted to hear, but he needed to hear it. You haven't been here for us.
No, and no one else could tell him that, right?
Yeah.
Sally's the only one.
And Henry's been a good man, and those kids do need stability during this trying time. So,
no, I don't disagree with her at all. So Don, right after that, calls Betty, and she tells him that she wants the kids to be in what she calls a normal environment, which is at her brother's house.
Final classic Don what's in the last scene, like two for the price of one. I'm glad we got that.
Okay. So several what's. In this episode, not just from Don. A lot from Peggy later on.
But the Dons are classic. Like, there's a really funny supercut of him just saying, what?
On the toilet.
After he just threw up, yes.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. Check it on YouTube. If you just say, like, Don Draper, what? It's like the first hit.
Yeah, but it seems more like in this scene, Betty saying the normal thing is not having Don around.
And that stings him so bad.
But it's so true.
He can't say anything about it because he knows it's true.
Yep.
He knows it's true.
And so, I mean, instead of saying something about it, they both kind of have a moment of silence and they have a cry together. He calls her Birdie one last time. The entire audience tears up, I think.
Can I ask you something? Because we've talked a lot of times about the limits of January Jones's talents.
Okay.
And I've seen her in other things, not Mad Men, that led me to believe that she is kind of only good at playing this ice queen, this timeless beauty. But she was excellent on, and I would just, I don't know one way or another, but I feel like the phone scenes have got to be a special hell for an actor because they don't have anyone to play off of. It's a solo performance. It's a solo spotlight performance. And she knocked it out of the park. They both did. I expected John Hamm to. Did she just raise her game for the finale here? Have we been overlooking what a good job she's done throughout the years? Have I judged January Jones too harshly, Jim?
They did 150 takes and they cut and strung together the performance just right. No,
they got Andy Serkis to do mocap and then they keyframe animated her face.
Uh-huh. No, I don't know. I agree that in the past, January Jones has not shown me much, but I can imagine that this was in a very emotional time. I think I read an interview with Don Draper. What's his name? John Hamm, where he was talking about those final scenes and kind of the outros for all these characters.
Sure.
And those phone scenes, they tried to arrange it so that they could be on the phone together.
Oh.
Or that they were actually in the same room while filming and the other person would be reading lines from the chairs behind him.
That must be a big help.
Yeah, I can imagine that that was like just a very emotional, like personally emotional thing. So it's not like she even really had to act.
That's
that
true.
Much,
like,
right?
Was that her last day of filming?
I think so. Like those phone calls were all kind of the finales for these characters are going to be in the room together.
Okay, well, that makes sense. I could see this being kind of a once-in-a-lifetime performance then, because I could see just personally being emotional about this thing coming to an end.
Yeah, and just not even having to act.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's it. So, yeah, they say goodbye for what's the final time there. Ken meets with Joan to ask her to use...
She Han Solo'd him, too, at the end with the I know.
Did she?
Yeah.
I thought he said I know.
No, he said birdie, and she responded, I know. And then she was dipped into carbon freezing pit. Controversial cure for lung cancer. What? But
no, I mean, she's trying to preserve her beauty.
It's, it's an early version of Alcor, the Alcor Foundation. They're going to, you know, her and...
started by C-Cor, surprisingly. Yeah. just dip you in strong enough laxatives and preserved.
Yeah, you never had a you've never been constipated until your guts are frozen with liquid nitrogen. I tell you what, nothing. There's no movement.
Nope. Ken meets with Joan to ask her to use her.
Should
contacts.
We explain the fact that this is all cryogenic stuff, or do we just make these jokes and move on?
No, we make the jokes and we move.
Okay,
on.
Okay, fine.
If I mean, you did just explain it, but we're still going to act like we didn't and move on.
Okay. I assume that you'll edit the podcast to maintain the mystery.
No, that's a big assumption.
Okay. Ignorance is bliss, baby.
Anyway.
I'm not going to listen to this mess. Come on.
So Ken meets with Joan to ask her to use his contacts or her contacts to help him create an industrial film for his department of Dow. This is a fairly charming scene. I like this.
Hell yeah, it is.
You know, Ken's trying to get right to business.
I just wrote off the Rolodex.
Yeah.
I poo-pooed the Rolodex last episode, and I was so wrong. I misjudged the wiener a final time because he thought that he'd forgotten it.
Yeah.
He had so not forgotten it.
Nope. It comes right back.
From this rock mass, she's going to build her production empire.
Or not. Who knows? Not.
But she could. She's going
to. Future is open.
Her future is secure. And so is little Kevin's.
Yes, absolutely. Anyway, so. I don't know what you want to say about that scene, but I think we can move on. It's just a nice little scene with some plot.
What
movement.
Did you think about Ken saying his kid? Eddie's a little weird. There might be something wrong with him. Was he just being funny?
Yeah, I thought so.
I'm gonna have to remember that.
Either that or like Eddie's got like Alzheimer's or something now.
Yeah, yeah. No, every once in a while, like, you know, I'm on LinkedIn and people will like message me and want to know if I'll introduce because they're trying to get a job in Indianapolis, a small town. And and they always start like, hey, how you doing? How's things in Cincinnati? How's your kids? Oh, fine. You know, and then it's like, oh, I need you to do blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, yeah, I haven't heard from you 3 years. I think I'm going to use this line. Anyone ask me about my kid, I'm going to be like, you know, he's a little weird. I think there's something wrong with him. Just to put him off guard, you know?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I thought you were going to go with the angle where Ken doesn't even bother with the small talk. He just comes right in. So I've got this job.
I like that. I prefer that. No, no, that's the thing. If you want something from me, just come. Don't try to butter me up.
Yeah.
I'm butter resistant.
Like Bobby's toast.
Exactly.
Anyway,
I'm more pan-fried grilled cheese than broiled.
The Landspeed guys show up at Don's hotel room, and they're looking for the steak money that he promised them, apparently.
Sure.
He is
super
drunk.
That beer
and gas
ain't gonna pay for itself.
No, no, it's not. You got to get the driver real drunk. He's a little scared.
I was a little afraid that until I understood that they just wanted the steak money, I was really weirded out that they were going to put him behind the wheel. And I'm like, God. Oh God, that shimmy might be navigable at 1:30 when you're sober, but
yeah, even if they fix the shimmy, it will be shimmying. He's super drunk. He decides he's going to go with them anyway, and they can drop him in L.A.
Sure.
I'm not sure when he kind of decided you know, I'm going to go see Stephanie, but that's obviously his next move.
Somewhere between case number one and case number two, I think.
Okay. I think he was drinking hard liquor, though.
No, he said he drank beer all night. He wanted to switch to hard liquor when he got to Stephanie's house.
Okay. So the next day, Joan calls Peggy to set up a lunch date, and she tells her about the Dow script and asks her to write it. Peggy's a little resistant, but then she agrees because Joan's a friend, and, you know, that's a lot of money. $1,200 for a 10-page script. I'll take it.
That's in 70s just money? Under $8,000 for 10 pages.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
As always, inflation calculators are fun. Peggy's really funny. Like, it's almost a stand-up routine, the whole, did you say hi to Ken for me? No, why would you say that? Like, she's so socially awkward, and she's, like, doing color commentary on her own social awkwardness in real time.
Yeah.
Peggy Olson, hell of a woman.
That feels pretty realistic. Yeah. I see people doing that once in a while.
I do it ironically every once in a while. It's fun.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm with a person I know and I'm doing my classic Aaron bullshit, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's me.
Or if you're across from Harry Crane, you'll start doing it to him.
Well, yeah. Any chance I could get to make Harry Crane feel uncomfortable, I'll take it.
Let me ask you this.
Challenge him to a sack off.
Has Harry Crane become a more ridiculous character to you than Pete Campbell? How do you feel about Harry Crane, and how do you feel about Pete Campbell at this point?
I feel like I nailed this once. Because Pete is grimy, and I described Harry with another adjective that I thought was right on, like sleazy. Mm-hmm.
I think it was greasy.
Maybe from the White Castle. Greasy, sleazy. There's something. Pete's got the refinement. He's got the blue blood that somehow gives him this tragic nobility, even as he's saying Jiminy Christmas and a thing like that, and Hell's Bells, and
yeah,
you know, the king ordered it. He looks ridiculous, but there's always some kind of dignity to him. Whereas Harry, like Pete Campbell is playboy, Harry is hustler.
Okay. That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
I also think that Harry has stayed a shit to the end, whereas Pete Campbell is definitely more personable and more, at the end of this series, is more willing to be nice to people.
So I've got this conceit that I want to run by you for the season wrap-up, where we judge characters on a you're okay or you're not okay scale.
Okay.
I think the difference is Pete, you can squint and think it might go terrible. That plane might go down, but he's looking like he's mostly okay.
Yeah.
Harry is in the not okay category for me. So, yeah.
Okay.
But no,
that's roughly how I feel, too.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Somehow Harry has eclipsed Pete Campbell as the character that I like the least.
Like, they're both fun to despise, but yeah. Harry has much fewer redeeming qualities. Although, yeah. Did you watch any of the extensive Mad Men marathoning that was going on last weekend?
No, I didn't see any of it.
I watched a lot, and early season Harry was arguably one of the nicer guys in the bullpen.
I thought so too, yeah.
But I felt like he somehow got this nice guys don't finish last complex and ran with that concept. Just
wasn't
fucking
he like,
ran with it.
Wasn't he basically hanging out with Ken the whole time before that? You think Ken maybe corrupted him and then went in an opposite trajectory?
He passed the asshole baton. Yeah, maybe. Because Ken's one of the good guys now.
Yeah. It's weird.
Yeah. I don't know.
They've come a long way.
Yeah, yeah.
So Don shows up at Stephanie's house in L.A. and he tries to give her back the ring that Anna gave him, but she doesn't want it. She tells him that she's headed up the coast for some kind of retreat, and then he takes a nap.
And it just like this mistaken thing because Stephanie thinks he's there from her parents or somehow to make her feel
guilty.
Yeah, to
guilt her about the kid.
Which she, you know, like Don, doesn't need much help in that department.
Yeah, she's tearing herself up about it.
Yeah.
Which we find out all about later.
Yep.
We can find out all about Roger and Marie this next scene. Laying
solid
in their hotel
gold.
Bed. Marie says she went up to Canada and saw Emil, and then Roger gets angry because he thought she was going up there to divorce him, not to fraternize with him. And she makes a point about, you know, when you leave me, when this whole thing goes south, I'm going to be penniless on the streets. I need a little security here. You know, she's making a case
sure
for why Roger might not be the most reliable. And I think that's fair.
It does escalate fast, though.
It does, yeah.
At one point, I think Marie killed someone with a trident. It got a little out of hand. It ends with Roger angrily wrapping himself up in the comforter and staggering out the door with what little shreds of dignity had left. Great.
Yeah.
Great. John Slattery, way underappreciated. I think that's kind of weird because people's like, oh, yeah, he's the guy at the quip. He's the funniest thing about Mad Men. But the physical comedy is on point.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. So Stephanie wakes Don up. Tells him, you're coming with me on her retreat.
Yeah, Don didn't get much good sleep, you know, on the couch. He would greatly prefer a coffin. It's really, really impacting his whole ability to properly sleep in the vampire position.
Yeah, you know, at least with a coffin, you can get both your elbows out to the side.
Yeah, when you're a tall man on a love seat, it's just Jackknife City.
I know, I slept on a couch this weekend. It was no good.
Yeah, and like, you know, imagine being another 8 inches taller, so you got more leverage.
Sure.
Weighing you down.
No good. Sally shows up at Castle Francistine, where Bobby is failing to make dinner. Bobby assumes she's there because Betty's going to die, and she tells him, no, that's not it, and then shows him how to make dinner.
I love Bobby ordering Gene out of the kitchen, and Gene's like feeble resistance. Like, he's taking a baton from Sally. Sally's taking a baton from Betty.
But I mean, more important than that, it speaks.
Yeah, that's true. Speaks. I forgot that we were having that debate about whether Pete's kid's fucked up, and now Ken threw his kid into the fucked up ring. But no, Gene speaks.
But barely.
He might have problems. He's Don Draper and Betty Francis's kid, but he
croaks it out too. It's not. It's not a kid who's used to speaking.
Yeah.
We'll say that.
You know, the first Mad Men podcast I ever listened to is called The Mad Men Recap. And it was famous by, it was two brothers, and one of them sounded exactly like John Hamm. I thought it was awesome. And they coined a lot of terms like Betty Monster, Rapey Pete. But they had this recurring joke that I never figured out where it came from about Gene being a warlock baby. Like he was the evil, he was a bad seed somehow. Okay. And I don't know why I'm all nostalgic about Mad Men, and that was one of my first Mad Men fan experiences.
Yeah,
and I still season 7. I think they've stopped doing it. They had some technical problems last year, and they had some scheduling things, and it got away from them. They weren't one of the survivors, and I really wish, if anyone knows why the Mad Men Recap podcast used to refer to Gene as a warlock baby, I between now and the season wrap up, I would be eternally in your debt. If you could tell me that.
After that, don't bother.
After the ship has sailed.
All right. Don and Stephanie arrive at the retreat in the middle of the night, and they find their accommodations are communal. And Don criticizes the activities that are planned for the following day as basically a bunch of hippie bullshit.
I wrote that exact words are in my bunch of hippie bullshit, word for word in my notes.
Mine is too.
Also, she's got
It's not an unfair categorization.
Other points are my notes. She has a very interesting, smug Drew Barrymore thing going on with her face.
All right. I can see that.
We're supposed to be open to this, Jim. We're supposed to be open to the smug hippie Barrymore bullshit.
Nope. Sorry. Not going to happen.
It is interesting to think about that this is a direct reaction to the button-down oppression of the 50s and 60s, though.
Yeah.
What we call hippie bullshit is a pendulum swing, some would say too far, into the other direction.
Okay.
But this is the societal X-lax, the C-core laxative that society needed to get their emotional constipation dealt with.
Yeah, and maybe if you, depending on how you view the end of this episode, maybe it's just what Don needed, too. You know, that other end of the spectrum kind of can meet in the middle somewhere with his personality from the 50s and his personality now. I don't know. Roger returns his son to Joan after, I guess, a day out with him.
Seems like it. What did he say? He took him out to pancakes.
Is that what he says? Okay.
Got his hand sticky.
Yeah. And then he tells her that he's going to leave a good chunk of his money to their son. And he wanted to give her a heads up in case that would complicate any of her relationships.
Sure.
Joan thinks it's pretty hilarious when he tells her that he's marrying Marie.
Oh, this whole scene is great. Like what she says about Greg.
Yeah.
No, he doesn't know. He's just a terrible person.
Yeah.
And he talks to Meg's mother, and she says, "That's spectacular. What a mess," as she's laughing.
It is. And Slattery's got a great, you know, Roger's got a great view on it, too.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. Yeah. Nobody cares.
It is funny. I agree. It's hilarious. It's ridiculous, but nobody cares.
What do you think about him saying, or Joan saying, somebody finally got the timing right? Was that a way of them saying that maybe if our timing had been right, something could happen?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, she just caught him in the wrong time. And if maybe they had come together now, it would be different.
Maybe.
But it didn't seem like it was filled with regret at all. It was just like,
no,
you know, we're both where we are now, and I'm kind of happy for you, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a best case scenario for ex-lovers, is that you can get to a place where you're happy with each other's successes.
Yeah, that's good. Don and Stephanie go to the first activity of the day, which is basically to walk around the room, then stop and communicate with the person next to you without talking.
Mm-hmm.
Most people get hugs. Don gets a shove.
But does hugging feel honest, Jim?
I don't know.
I would like to start a podcast series. Hugging. I don't know what's about, but I want to call it Does Hugging Feel Honest?
Okay. It'll just be Mad Men recaps.
Yeah. I wonder what we, like, it'd be interesting to have alternative, like, Mad Men podcast names. Maybe that's something we can brainstorm for next week's show. Like, if we didn't call it the happy hour, what would we have called it? Like, what are all the different inside jokes and stuff we could have spun up?
Yeah. Yeah,
especially if we didn't care about any kind of, like, iTunes ranking or anything.
I think there could be something interesting if you took someone who is very much into this kind of hippie bullshit culture, as we call it, and had them review Mad Men, like, from the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, what would they make of Don in the late 50s, early 60s?
They did the a lot more crystals. The linchpin.
On the show, or?
Just everything could be solved with more crystals.
Okay.
The chakra is all off on the show.
Yeah. You're right about that. Peggy and Joan meet for lunch. John,
what did the old woman shove Don? Because he wasn't even looking at her.
I mean, he has his hands, like, his posture is very closed. And I wonder if that isn't part of it. Like, she sees him in this button down shirt. He's standing in a stance that's very off putting. Yeah. I just felt like she reacted to his visible presence as a person who was stuck in, you know, the 50s.
Well, after watching the show for 4 times and drinking a lot of whiskey, I thought, I've got this weird theory about every step of this therapy process is prying his shell a little bit further open.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how, I think, again, I need a little bit more whiskey and maybe a couple more watches and thinking, but I was trying to think, like, what, it was not just his body language, but also the fact that he was more into what was going on there with Stephanie.
Okay. Yeah, he's looking over at her, and she's like,
I need to make a statement. I need to be taken seriously as a human being.
And, you know, I bet Don is asking himself that very same question. Why did she shove me? And as far as opening up his shell, that's what you got to do, right?
Does shoving feel honest?
I think so.
I can see shoving Don Draper.
Yeah. Peggy and Joan meeting for lunch. Joan gives her the check for her work. Says that she has more work on the table, ready to go.
It's just the tip of the iceberg, Jim.
Yeah.
Just the tip.
And she tells Peggy she wants to create a production company with the name Harris Olsen.
I squealed like a little girl.
That would be pretty amazing.
At this
point
in the scene.
Yeah.
Like, it was disgusting. Me and my girlfriend on the couch were just like, you know, it's like the Ron Paul gif. It's happening, you know.
Yeah.
I bet laser beams are coming out and...
I bet this wasn't the only time you did that.
No, yeah,
this episode. There's good, another good scene call. That I'm guaranteeing.
Good call. No,
there were kittens and rainbows. Yeah, and all sorts of.
There
unicorns.
Was Japanese emoticons in my eyes during this whole scene. You know, I
for sure.
Damn, I was so. And you know what? The fact that they didn't do it feels very authentic.
It does.
But I love the fact that they put it, they flopped it out there onto the desk and had us deal with it.
Yeah,
it was such. Again, it's super fan servicey and also extremely extremely authentic. And when she says that, you know, we're going to build something of our own, we don't have to answer to anyone. It was just awesome. And the fact it's like, look, I can find another writer. This partnership is just for you. Just awesome. Peggy desperately gulping Bloody Marys. So fucking awesome.
Here's a huge opportunity in front of me potentially, but
yeah,
but it upsets so much of the stuff she's worked for, right?
And, you know, like I said, it feels more authentic that she would stay at McCann Erickson.
I thought so, too.
But I don't know it was really the best choice for her.
It's tough to say.
Because the one thing that I, as much as fun as it would be to see like a spinoff of Harris Olsen, they have got a very kind of combustible personality mix.
Absolutely.
So you wonder what a partnership with them would be like.
They have very different life experiences, you know? That confrontation between them in the elevator, I think, is telling to a large degree. I mean, Joan thinks, man, we can go do our own thing. You can be free of all the sexual harassment over at McCann. Peggy doesn't see as much of that as Joan saw. And I think that
she sees a lot of sexism, but it's not like I want to get in your pants sexism. It's like pat you on the head and go sell lipstick and tampons.
It's a different vibe over there for her
sure.
than it is for Joan. And I feel like that is one of the determining factors in her not being, you know, super eager to jump on this potential opportunity.
Yeah.
Whereas Joan is just like, I'm giving you the greatest thing on earth on a silver platter here. Let's go do it.
Right.
She has a different look on it. And I think that's appropriate for their characters.
Right.
So we go back to a group meeting in the retreat here where Stephanie says that she feels like people are judging her. And she says that she doesn't want to take care of her baby, which causes a woman to chime in with her opinion. Like, this is how I feel. Oh, forget how you feel. Here's how I feel.
Sure.
Seems a little selfish there. She
is
sends,
it though?
I mean, the point of this is for Stephanie to get out how she feels, right?
I don't know what the point of this, because it just seemed like I don't know, everyone pointing guns at each other and shooting. It's hippie bullshit run amok.
Yeah, it felt, okay, so I guess a more apt thing to say here would be that it felt out of place for what I usually think of when I think of group therapy sessions.
Okay.
Like, judging is almost forbidden. Like, you don't tell someone that, you know how your statement makes me feel? It makes me feel angry. I don't know. I've never been to a group therapy session, but...
That seems like something to hear.
That's my opinion based on media, I guess.
Well, when you say your opinion, it makes me feel like you're wrong.
It makes me feel like you're the biggest dumbass on the planet.
Like you're a giant asshole. And, you know, I know it's a fine line between judging someone and also saying, I think that you're making a mistake. And like this woman's coming from a place where, you know, let's take her at her face value and she was abandoning it. That's a valid experience. Like the choice you're making to run away from your child is going to have a negative effect on that child. But ultimately, if you can't be happy, then that's going to have a negative effect on your child as well.
Okay.
Like, it's one of those things where there's not a lot of great solutions there, and there's not a way to just I don't know that there's a way that you can dismiss your guilt. I thought it was really interesting in the same way that I thought it was interesting some of this stuff with Jesse Pinkman going to group therapy. Like, when you've done something that society considers something heinous, like mothers abandoning their children, a father through negligence accidentally killing his child, whatever. It's easy to say you're okay and you need to move forward when you've done something like broke your marriage vows or something. But the worst you get on the scale of bad things, the harder it must be to go on.
Yeah, I imagine so. I mean, she runs out of this place and Don chases after her. And
like, let's say that you're in prison for murdering 10 people and then you find Jesus and you want to move on with your life. How do you ever love yourself again?
I don't know. I'm not a murderer.
Thank God. But yeah, like, you know, I just
thank
wonder,
me. I've never murdered anyone.
Yeah. Well, it's still, you know, you got time.
You're right. I do.
You got 5-10 years left at least.
I have time in this podcast. So who knows? So Stephanie goes running out. Don follows her, offers to move to LA and help her. He's like, I feel like he's trying to give her what he thinks she needs, and that's not it. He tells her, like, put all this behind you, it'll get easier, and she doesn't think he's right about that.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know. Don says some interesting things here. You don't know what happens to people when they believe in things.
I think he's trying to say that Judgy Girl was a, like a, some kind of Jesus freak or something.
Oh, yeah,
or,
no.
Or whatever the hippie bullshit equivalent of that is.
Sure, yeah. I don't know. This is where I guess this stuff started to feel weird, because it didn't feel like it was about Don. It felt like it was about Stephanie. Uh-huh. And I honestly don't care that much about Stephanie.
Yeah.
Especially in a finale episode.
But it's also about Don, too.
It is, but tangentially in this particular scene.
And like her rejection of him is like, you're not my family. What's the matter with you? Like, Don's attention towards Stephanie has always felt somehow inappropriate. Like, outright inappropriate when they first met. Like, oh, yeah. Jesus.
Is Are they going to get
Is he going to seduce her to, like, just borderline, if I save you, it somehow makes me a good person.
Yeah.
Kind of inappropriate. Like, a lot of his hopes and dreams and salvation relies on, well, I couldn't save the girl from Wisconsin, so I'm going to save the girl from California.
Yeah.
That I have a very tenuous relationship with. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. There is definitely something weird about their relationship. But let's go over to Stan, who is about to leave. But he stops into Peggy's office. She pours him a drink, tells him about the offer from Joan, and then Stan basically says, keep doing what you're doing. And Peggy says, no, gets angry at him, starts yelling at him, and he gets insulted and runs out of the room.
It felt like an interesting parallel to Roger and Marie, like that things just devolved and downward spiraled so fast.
Okay.
That I felt like what Peggy wanted was to be talked out of it. But Stan was like, well, yeah, do whatever you want to do. And she was mad that he wasn't.
No, I mean, Stan was like, you got a good thing here. Why are you going to go mess that up?
But it turned out to be an indictment of his ambition more than the idea that was presented to Peggy. But and I think because Peggy was all presenting positive aspects. I don't know. I could have my own thing. I could be my own boss. I could do whatever I want. And,
yeah, yeah. And he's like, oh, that's kind of bullshit.
Yeah, but that's kind of secretly what she wanted to hear. She wanted the idea. I felt like that she wanted to be talked out of the idea, and he was just like not really super interested in doing that. He's like, well, you'd be good at anything, which is true. That's a way of dodging the question and having an opinion.
I
think she really wanted to hear him say, I want you to stay because I want
you. You might be right. Yeah, I think that's where it's more complicated, because later on, you know, she calls him up and apologizes and says, you're always right. Like, what? I'm sorry I threw you out of my office. You're right about it.
Yeah.
You know? And then they profess their love for each other, all that stuff. I think it's definitely more complicated than just she wants to be talked out of it. She kind of wants, you know, she wants him involved in it.
Sure.
I don't know, in some way.
I thought that was another possibility, that he would be one of the, you know, Harris Olsen first hires.
Yeah, potentially.
You can't have your... although I've said it out loud, you can't have a production company with the nickname of Ho if it's started by two women. This is a bad idea, Joan.
You're right. You're right. I hadn't even considered it. So what, are you going to put Stan up there? Rizzo?
No, it's Olsen
whore?
Harris. And it's,
you going to turn it into whore?
It's Olsen, no, Olsen Harris. Oh. Oh.
Oh.
This is a boutique. Oh. Oh, I didn't see it in this light.
Okay.
It's not Ho, it's O.
So what do you make of Stan leaving and telling her there's more to life than work? Is that him hinting? Is that him saying, look, we're here. Why are you throwing me out? We're having a good time. There's more to life than work. We should hook up.
No, I didn't get that. I get more like just deep hurt, deep hurting of her saying terrible things to him.
She tends to do that.
And the look on his face when he's like, you know, it's like he's wiping shit off out of his eyes. Like, you know what? I don't have to put up with this.
Yeah.
Do you think he's broken up with the nurse yet at this point? That's the one thing that was bugging me.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. That look when he gets back into bed with her
and realizes he's been a shit.
He's dissatisfied.
Yeah.
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 So Don's sleeping with Stephanie. Or no.
Whoa!
He's not sleeping with Stephanie.
Although I was terrified, honestly. That would have been a fault. I was like, oh, God. God.
No, he is sleeping.
And it's Chekhov's Stephanie, blonde girl, and she's finally come home to roost in the finale.
No, God, no. Don's sleeping. Stephanie comes into the room and gets into bed.
What do you make of that?
Very short scene there. He was awake, so obviously he's been kind of waiting up, hoping she'll come back. Because I don't know where she's been. She said she was going to bed earlier, but she got up and roamed.
I think they were setting up a parallel of the way she uses men. and the way Don uses women, like that she is now hooked up with some rando and she's going to go on to the next one and abandon Don there in the same way that he has done in so many ways to the people that he's loved and cared about.
Okay.
They worry about
him. That's a lot to get from this very short
scene. I know, but they worry about him, and the more intensely they worry and try to show concern, the further he runs away.
Yeah. I just thought it was literally a way to move the plot along.
Okay.
Anyway, Richard and Joan have breakfast in her apartment. Joan has to cancel her plans, or sorry, their plans, because she has a business meeting. And Richard doesn't see room in Joan's life for himself and her new business. And it's clear that her mind is made up, so he wishes her luck, and he goes out the door.
A lot of people saying, what an asshole, Richard. He's so unsupportive. I cannot get on that board, that train.
No.
I thought this was a very mature adult decision that he said without... I mean, of course he's disappointed. Of course he's hurt. Of course he doesn't, you know, but I think...
And of course Joan is when he leaves, like, you know?
This isn't, but he doesn't have... Like, he's always been very upfront about what he wanted, and he's compromised and been flexible. But he knows what it takes, the kind of attention it takes to start something new and build it from scratch.
He's done this.
And he's in a different phase in his life. And if she wants to do that, then he's got no desire to do that with her.
And I here's think that's the thing.
An entirely fair thing to say.
Yeah. I mean, his line where he says, you act like this is happening to you, but you're making a choice, is very telling. She absolutely is making a choice.
And he is.
He's
too.
Also making a choice. It's not like he's. This is completely rational, in my opinion.
No, everyone decides what price of admission that they're willing to pay for a life experience. And he was willing to pay the price of having a young child involved, and he's willing to pay the price to move to New York. But this, like, all that plus you're going to have all your time. I get in. It felt very rational. He wasn't cruel. He wasn't like, you know, I've seen Don, like, you know, call Megan a whore when he's disappointed and he wants to leave.
Yeah.
But he just said, it wasn't with a lot of mirth or warmth, but I wish you luck, Joan, and left out the door.
And you got to imagine that this is saving them a lot of heartbreak down the road.
You're
only going to get more invested if this goes on. And he sees, he has the crystal ball here. He's been through it all.
He doesn't want to be rooting for her to fail so he can have the relationship he wants. That's not a good look on him.
Exactly.
I was surprised at how many people, I think it's a knee-jerk reaction because we like Joan. We want Joan to be happy. But again, I felt like it was a very healthy adult decision that was derived at, and the way they both dealt with it was beautiful.
I agree completely. Prepare for the hate mail, Aaron.
Ah, well, bring it on.
Don wakes up and Stephanie isn't there. He goes outside where this...
Who the fuck was on the phone, and what kind of goddamn miscreant lets a phone ring for 5 fucking minutes?
It's back in the day. No.
Yeah, I lived back in that day. Once it rang like 5-6 times, unless someone was dying, you hang up and you try again later. What the actual fuck? I was like, it was killing me. This was worse than Raylan and Ava and the baby screaming in a hotel. I couldn't fucking believe how stressed out I was by this phone just ringing and ringing and ringing in the background. Thank God for voicemail. I never have to listen to that for more than 4 rings. Jesus. It really bugged me.
I'm now devising ways in my head that I could get a phone to ring in your house for a very long time.
I would burn the place down and move after the 7th ring, man. That's despicable. That's a cycle. She needs to fire that client. No client's worth that kind of entitlement.
Jeez. All right. I'm glad we don't have clients in this business because they would all be gone by now.
We have listeners, but they don't have easy access to our phone number.
No.
And also, they would only be able to ring at most 4 times.
Yep. Anyway, Don wakes up. Stephanie's not there. He goes outside. It's a naked man who says she left a few hours ago. Don goes to the front desk to get a car to try to leave. They tell him, you can't. You can't get one until the end of the week. My God, you're stuck in hippie hell. This is hippie hell.
Hippies don't have phones. Right, like, I wasn't sure. Well, they have a phone.
They don't have cars.
Yeah, but do they have
taxis?
How
do they get there? Yeah.
Don is fucking rich. Like, okay, do I have a phone? I can call a limo service. I will pay them $500 to come and get me. Done deal.
Yeah, you would think so.
A little bit contrived. The one, I mean, I said that there's not a sour note, and, it took me 4 times for this to actually bug me. Also, the psychopath calling for 5 minutes, that was another sour note. But, no, I felt like that this was a little bit stranded on a desert isle, but probably no good reason.
I agree. It was a little silly.
I mean, the not being able to hitch because of Charlie Manson, ha ha ha. That's the wiener.
That makes sense. I like
troll face Matthew Weiner. That's all good, but no, it's a little contrived.
What do you make of the line? People just come and go, and no one says goodbye.
Well, people are free to come and go as they please, Jim.
They are. There were a couple of goodbyes here in this episode. That's, and we just talked about one.
Uh-huh.
From Joan. I mean, Don is obviously speaking about his life, you know. Mm-hmm. But he definitely says goodbye to Betty at the end of their call.
Well, I guess. I feel like they talk again.
You think so? I mean, tells him don't come home.
Yeah, but she says, I'll talk to you later or something like that. Yeah, I mean, so yeah, and don't come home, don't rush home, don't do anything out of the ordinary. But I don't know. I feel like in the 6 months she has left to live that they talk a few more times.
Okay.
I don't think he gets custody of the kids. But, you know, they have a special relationship.
They do.
And understand.
It's a weird one, but it's
a lot of shared, history.
Yeah.
One of the, because I got random snippets of, like, I felt like I had this fortune of tuning into, like, the greatest moments of Mad Men. Like, I got the Bobby Barrett episode where Don gave her the threatening finger bang. I got the episode where Betty stumbles into Don's locked box of faked identity. Oh,
you're talking about the marathon. Okay.
Yeah, the marathon. And, like, you know, I can't even remember where I was going with this. But that moment, like, you know, when she found out that, like, his life was all a lie, like, that's a unique thing between them. Like, he came clean to Megan from the beginning because of that experience that he learned with Betty. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. It's like, it's not fair to say Don never learns anything.
Yeah.
Because he did try to get out of the pattern with Megan. He just, I mean, that's one of my core arguments of this finale and why I see it as optimistic, because the thing that was always missing from Don is he never learned to love himself.
Yeah.
He was always finding something else to try to fill into that hole, and it never did fit right. And I feel like him hugging this man and this group was literally him finding that self-love he needs. That's my theory anyway. But we're not quite there. So I jumped the therapy gun a little bit.
A little bit, but yeah.
I need an old woman here to push me. Put me in my place.
So Don calls up Peggy in the third and final phone call that he talked to Sally already. Yeah.
Yep.
Don calls Peggy, who is angry at him for taking off, and she tells him, come back home. He says he can't because he's messed everything up.
Did you get that was a very husband wife thing to say?
Yeah.
Come home, Don.
Or like a mother's thing to say. I mean, we've always kind of gone there with Peggy and Don. That was a very motherly thing to say.
Yeah. I was, at this point in the episode, I was still wondering if there was going to be a Peggy Don ship sailing.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Because, like I said, that was just such a very housewife thing to say to him. You've had enough fun. It's time to come home. You have a home to come to. Come home. That's a very weird come home.
I feel like I recall Pete being told that or something a long time ago.
Yeah.
By Trudy.
It's such a weird thing for Peggy to say to him, that exact phrasing.
Yeah.
I buy it because they do. They have, you know, speaking of special relationships, my God.
Yeah, sure.
I randomly tuned in, got the suitcase episode.
Okay, wow.
Like, I was playing, like, fucking...
Although, to be fair, tune into Jukebox any Mad Roulette Men,
that's true.
And they're all good.
Find an hour and tell me it's a shitty one. Yeah. Like, this is the one that Betty shoots pigeons with a rifle and a cigarette hanging out of her lip. Uh-huh. Baddest ass moment of her life. Yeah, yep. No, it's hard to find a bad one. Fair point.
Indeed. So he lists his sins off to Peggy, and... Okay, would you say this is an official goodbye?
Yeah, although I think that he does. I think Don goes back to McCann.
I do too. Yeah, so I'm sure they talk in the future.
Very suicidal and scary.
Yeah, Peggy is very worried about him not being alone.
As was I. In fact, the fact that final 10 minutes of this fucking episode takes place on a cliff... really had my fear for Don Draper meter. And I think that's the thing that's brilliant about the wiener, man, is I think he's aware of all those buttons that he's pushing. Like, he's playing emotional minor chords the whole time, but he knows he's going to take it in this other way. But he knows what the expectations and the things that are being talked about on the internet are, so he's deliberately using this to have a more cathartic experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't imagine that he doesn't tailor some of his stuff to specifically mislead, red herrings and such. There's something she says here to Don that I think factors into how I view the final scene with the commercial. She says, "I know you get sick of things and you run, but you can come home."
Mm-hmm.
That combined with some other stuff that we've heard and will hear later in this episode, I just want you to keep that line in mind.
Keeping it in mind. I'm keeping it in mind. And I love the, you know, again, the phone acting. Whew, but yeah. Don almost physically collapsed like a building being a controlled demolition.
I was worried about a heart attack at that point.
Yeah.
Like, is the stress going to get to him?
It seemed like he was having a very severe panic attack.
Yeah.
Just getting through that conversation with Peggy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Peggy calls Stan, tells him, "Hey, I spoke with Don," and apologizes for what she said the previous day, and Stan confesses his love for her. And then Peggy goes, "Hmm." She thinks about it for a second. She's like, "Oh, yeah, I guess I love you, too." In what is a pretty awkward scene from her. Like, I think it's phenomenal acting. Peggy, the character, is just so awkward. Like, what did you say?
What?
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 He says it like three times, and each time she's like, did I hear what I think I heard?
Well, it's interesting because, like, even Stan says it. Like, when we first met and we thought about, I think we were covering this on the podcast. If not, we certainly were covering it in our pre-podcast couch chats about the Wieners work and how we felt. I can't remember if it's season 3, season 4, but I remember thinking, like, Stan and what I thought about him and what Piggy was, and, like, mm-hmm. Peggy threw it right back in his face. It's like, all right, let's take our clothes off and work. And, yeah. Like, that was the start of the relationship and how antagonistic it was. But then it moved into this weird mutual support respect thing, and then they switched agencies, and they had those long late-night phone chats while they were – And it came out of the blue, but also was extremely natural.
I completely agree.
And also, like Peggy says, like, the tip of the iceberg, I never know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Like, when this man declared her love, she went through that entire, you know, SWOT analysis about whether this is a good thing and do I feel the same, and I never think about you, except for I always think. It's, like, really awkwardly well played. And you know, I was expecting towards the end Stan to walk in, but then, like, when it was a beat too long and a beat too long and a beat too long, and he just came sprinting, like,
barreling.
I thought it's so funny and oh god, I
loved it.
Yeah, I had Japanese emoticons in my eyes on this scene too.
Me too.
So great. It's the best, man. And he's looking there when he smiles at her. It's exactly like the goddamn Grizzly Adams gif that everybody, you've seen that one, right?
Which one?
It's the one that looks like Stan smiling, where he, like, you know, it's a big bearded man, and he looks up and he breaks out in a big grin as it zooms in on his face. It's all over the internet. You're on the internet, aren't you? It's the Grizzly Adams GIF.
Yeah.
Google Grizzly Adams GIF. It's the first thing that you'll see. I'm certain. I'd stake my life on it. But he's magnificent. Yeah. Peggy is awesome.
This is the moment I think everyone's been waiting for, right?
Yeah, heart three sizes too big. I've pulled a total Grinch on this.
Yeah. The other line in here that I want to talk about with Don, as it relates to Don, is when they're talking about Don, and Stan says he always does this and he always comes back. He's a survivor. He's going to be okay.
And Peggy says, "You're always right."
Yeah. Yeah. I want to save that again. Keep that in mind. We'll talk about it at the end.
That double.
But this also factors into what I think about the ending of this episode.
Same here.
Okay. Let's move on. Don's sitting by the phone, and a woman from the group session finds him, invites him to her seminar. When they get there, a guy in a blue sweater says that he feels like he's an item in the refrigerator that no one wants, doesn't know how to love himself, all that stuff. Don totally identifies with this. And he goes over and hugs him when he starts crying. And they both cry together. I mean, this is Don seeing into himself.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this Don is giving this guy, like, who has finally recognized that he doesn't appreciate the love that he's being given, giving him love that he can't ignore.
Yeah.
And by by doing that, also giving himself love.
So I don't know if you got on forums, but Jamie T had this hot theory about this man, this like this kind of like a, you know, he's more of a Pete Campbell cut, but from behind he gives a profile of like the Don Draper sitting on the couch from the credit sequence. And that Don going to hug this man was as close as you're going to get of Don hugging Dick Whitman, or vice versa, that you're ever going to get. And I had a surreal experience of reading that exact same take on Reddit. I'm like, what the fuck? Someone ripped, and then I realized it was Jamie in a Reddit persona. And it's like, okay. Anyway, okay. I thought that was a really smart take on that. That this is literally an act of self-love. Like,
oh yeah,
this is a man articulating all the things that he deep down thinks, and which is ridiculous because Don's the most interesting fucking man in the world. And he's magnetic and people can't look away from him. But that's how he feels.
Yeah, he doesn't recognize that. And recognize the love that people are giving him.
And also the look on his face when he says, no one cares that I'm gone. And I think Don had this realization that I just talked to Peggy and she misses me and she wants me to come home. That's at least one thing that I've got that this guy doesn't have.
Yeah.
I think is another one of those crucial scenes to properly understanding what's going on in this episode.
So you think at the end of this,
I think this is the linchpin of the whole episode, whether you think this is cynical or optimist, is, you know, if you think of like a 12-step program, the first step is admitting that you have a problem. I think Don did that in season 4. One of the last steps is to learn to accept and love yourself and to forgive yourself.
Yeah.
And I feel like for the first time ever, Don, you know, he's gone through and he's apologized to everyone he's wronged, including Sally, including Megan, including Betty. He's made peace with us. Like, you can kind of see Mad Men as him working through in the last three seasons, the 12-step program or a similar type of thing.
No, I think that's right on the money. Don, at least in this moment, has a very profound realization of himself. And I don't know. I always go back to how Don described love at the beginning of this series, which is basically something created by admin to sell nylons. That is a man who doesn't recognize that love exists. And in this moment, he certainly does. He realizes that he's been getting love. He just hasn't recognized it and has been ignoring it.
Okay. All right.
He's, you know, and because of that, he's become the guy in the fridge who no one goes to for that love.
What I thought was interesting is how when they zoomed out and they saw all these hippies standing around and everyone looks kind of variously smug and uncomfortable, I thought it was, I don't know why, but I thought it was interesting that this is the kind of thing that they're, I guess, trying to achieve, right? But
these kind of breakthroughs, yeah.
Yeah, but the leader of the group is just like very nonchalant about it. And a lot of the hippies that are there for this program are like I know the young girl especially was just like didn't know what to do with herself. She's like, oh, God, this is very uncomfortable and weird. So, yeah. I don't know.
I mean, it seems like an uncomfortable, weird scenario.
The hippie bullshit was turned upon themselves.
Yeah, how do you like that?
It's a black hole of hippie bullshit. Gargantuan, if you will.
We get some final goodbyes in this next montage, I guess.
Pete's amazing JFK lifestyle.
Yeah, man. Pete gets out of limo and right into a Learjet. Not bad.
Yeah, well, you know.
With his perfect little family there.
There's always hope, you know. Plane crashes, run into family.
Oh, that kind of hope.
Yeah, sure.
The hope that it will end in destruction.
No, the director. We're gonna find out in the director's cut that Trudy and the daughter, there was like a last minute hitch with their luggage, and they had to get off the plane. And you know, Pete's got a tight deadline, so he had to go. That plane crashed.
Yeah. Okay.
Trudy's the one she was following at. It was fine, and she lived happily ever after.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like they're giving most of these people a very happy send off.
Yeah. Hope the German au pair is doing as well.
So Joan's running her business out of her home. We see that and she looks very happy.
Yep. Babysitter that was previously ruining her life is now running it. That was interesting.
And there is not a thought in her head about Richard.
And the
Richard
Holloway and the fact that you got to have two names to make it official and she's using Holloway Harris.
Perfect.
Oh, so good. Ah, oh, so good.
Marie and Roger are in a cafe in France, and Roger orders food for them in France.
It was in France?
Yeah.
It wasn't in Quebec?
No, it's in France.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, apparently they went to Paris. I don't know.
All right.
That's what I was reading in reviews, but I don't know how you tell that.
Okay.
Because I at first assumed it was Canada.
I assumed it was in French Canada somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, well.
But, you know, him calling her mother, his mother, it's like, yeah, it's so cute.
Yeah. And he's learning the language. You know, all he got before was suitcase. Now he's getting a lot.
Yep.
He's figured it all out. Sally's doing dishes while her mother sits at the table, reads the paper, and smokes.
People giving Betty shit for smoking.
Who cares?
That's like, you got 6 months to live, you got lung cancer, smoke like a fucking chimney.
I mean,
why not?
Give her shit for smoking in the same room as her kids, sure. Give a dying woman shit for smoking, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, I forgot about the kids angle. That's a fair point.
Yeah, you would think she wouldn't want her kids repeating her pattern there.
Like, if you've been successfully through some kind of surgery and you survived and you're still smoking, then...
Sure.
Then you can get a little judgy, like someone smoking through their tracheotomy scar or something like that. Okay, yeah. That's fucked up.
But if
you're dying, then smoke them if you got them, man.
I agree. Peggy's typing, stands there rubbing her shoulders. So they're a happy couple at McCann, it appears, and we hope they stay that way for a long time. I guess I don't want to necessarily talk about where we think all these characters are going to end up because, you know, Mad Men's trying to tell us that these people are happy in the moment.
Yeah. Even Betty's at peace.
It is just now, but it might be in the future. And that's a good thing. You know, it might continue for them to be a happy place.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most optimistic way to end a story that is effectively about living life.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Ultimately, everybody's life ends badly. They die.
Yeah.
But you could be happy.
Life's a terminal condition.
Yeah. And we saw here the Jones calendar shows November 1970. I wanted to note that. So know where we end the series. And then we go to Don, who as I suppose the most important character in Mad Men. He's meditating. He's doing his ohms when an idea hits
him.
Love
the ohms.
And a smile comes over him.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut to one of the most famous commercials of all time, if not the most famous.
Yeah, it's consensus number one.
I think so. I mean, I wasn't alive when this thing came out, and I still know about it.
I remember seeing a 35 millimeter. I was going through this box of 35 millimeter films of my parents after they got divorced, and I stumbled upon my entire side of my mom's family, with all my aunts and uncles, they recreated this commercial at some family reunion for some kind of joke. And it was because it's, you know, it didn't have sound with it. So it's just them silently lip syncing this thing.
Oh,
and I don't know
weird.
If there's an audio to recording that goes like some kind of reel to reel or old cassette tape that goes with it that would, but it was like a really surreal experience.
That sounds so strange.
Yeah.
I can't believe how shitty the overhead shot is in this commercial.
Well,
like, I mean, yeah, granted, it's the 70s. I don't know what the tech was like back then, but
six axis stability drones.
Apparently not, because it's real shitty. And I, oof, that's a rough overhead. Anyway, I want to first ask you, because I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about this scene. Let's establish some ground rules here.
Okay.
Can we agree that Don made the Coke ad?
I think that Don did make the Coke ad.
Okay.
I don't know that
I think
you can
our,
conclusively prove that.
I think there's a lot to hint at it. I think the bell going off at the very end, him smiling is, I mean, what more do you want? A light bulb over his head?
Sure.
I feel like that is the idea moment.
McCann Erickson actually did produce that ad in real life.
Yeah.
That's evidence for, and it was actually the fall of 71, so less than a year away.
Yeah. And with all this stuff about coming home.
Now, one person put as evidence against, and it was kind of meta and out of universe, but Matthew Weiner sometime in like season 4 said that he's never going to give Don Draper credit for an actual ad. However, Lucky Strike, It's Toasted, was a real life ad that he did give credit for in the pilot.
Yeah, so I read about that.
I don't know that you can use that as a conclusive proof that it's not. Plus, it's the fucking finale, man. Now,
and there isn't any hard, concrete evidence that Don created it.
No.
He doesn't actually give him credit for it.
I mean, you could also see that this is him being truly happy.
Mm-hmm.
The real happiness in contrast
to... this is a thematic thing, not...
the fake happiness that they're peddling with Coca-Cola. Or you could say that Don came back to New York City and told his experiences to Peggy, and this is a... You know, one emailer put it, this is the student becoming the master thing, and you're supposed to realize that this was Peggy and that she wrote it. There's no evidence to support that as well. There, the other primary thing that people take is that Don is not learning anything and that he is just going back to New York and becoming an admin, and he's not going to be involved in his life meaningfully. And he's going to be one of those guys that die given his pitch.
So that's why
I think that there's nothing that disproves that in this episode either.
That's where I actually fall. And I think there's stuff to support that with, you know, Stan saying this is what he does. He goes out. He is the vampire of ad pitching. He takes in experiences from everyone around him. He forms them into ads, and he's considered a genius for that. This is what he does. He goes roaming. He comes home with an idea, which he pitches. And Don has never changed. And I think you have to, in order to accept that outcome, you have to believe that Don is only having a breakthrough in the moment when he goes up and hugs this guy, and that he will then basically forget that. That will not be a lasting effect on who Don is.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm not going to hate anybody for having that a point of view, but I'm saying, and I might be wrong because one of the things I want to do is go back and rewatch this whole series, but I thought that there was a lot of interesting things about what this guy was saying at the time, that this is, you know, you take the Jamie T interpretation of the Don hugging this refrigerator man as being him loving himself. You got this guy saying this is a new day with new hope and new ideas and a new you. That you got Don bemoaning the fact that he never did anything with this man's name. I think you can just as easily spin this as saying that this is the true epiphany, not just for the diet, not just for the Coke angle, but for what he needs to love himself and to finally let Dick Whitman rest and become Don Draper. And I don't think that
I agree.
Like, Don's life as an admin is not the reason he was a shitty father. He's a shitty father because of all the childhood trauma that allowed him to have this giant hole that was, you know, he tried to fill with all this love, but he didn't have any love for himself. He didn't have any self-respect.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's a definite change that happened in this episode. I don't think it's ever...
Is it lasting, though? We've seen Don have not quite these profound moments.
Exactly.
But he's similar had moments where which he just spins into ads and then becomes Don Draper again.
But before season four, I'll argue that there was never, like, yes, he just did that and there was no change at all. Season four, he started to make changes. Season five, he tried to act on those changes and failed. Season six was all about him owning his failures and making amends to the people that he hurt. And also being honest with showing the world that Dick Whitman part of himself is Don Draper, even though it was self-destructive. And season seven has been about the synthesis of all this that led up to this speech where this hippie's given sun salutations and it's a new day and new hope and new ideas and new you. That's why I'm optimistic about it. But
yeah, I think you can obviously read it both ways. And I think I was reading around on the forums at forums.ballmove.com if you want to participate. Pavlov's Bell had an idea that, you know, those two things are not mutually exclusive. Going back to McCann,
yes,
creating this ad is not mutually exclusive with Don having true growth.
Sure.
And I think that's true. I just take away a lot of the stuff that has been said about Don and his patterns in previous seasons, and I say I'm not sure that Don remains as affected by that epiphany as we'd like him to.
I think that is an entirely viable way to look at it.
Yeah. The other one is, you know, kind of more meta, where Don doesn't create this ad and this is more just there to reflect the peaceful state that has come over him and his new understanding of himself. And I think that's valid as well.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of hint that he did make this ad.
Yeah.
Within the show. So a lot of interpretations are possible here. And that's why I think it's about the best ending you could have.
I think it's interesting that it seems like the more cynical the interpretation an individual took, the less they liked the episode. Whereas I saw this as a very life-affirming, I mean, I thought it was, you know, I've done a lot of personal work myself, but I thought, you know, that thing at the end with him hugging the refrigerator guy was really powerful. And the things that they're talking about is things that, you know, people struggle with all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I think especially it's hard for men because Culturally, we're not supposed to do things like that. We're not supposed to bear our feelings and be vulnerable and then accept love from other men.
Okay.
So I thought there was like really powerfully and personally moving and kind of life affirming for me. And I love this episode. If people saw this as another turn of the wheel, and that's the thing, like I thought I came away bringing this back to the carousel, and I know a lot of people went to this well, but you think in terms of how a Kodak carousel slideshow thing works. It's these big, large and alive, glowing images of us at our best and our brightest, our personal highlights.
Okay. Yeah, there's a snapshot of happiness.
In between, everything fades to black.
Uh-huh.
And then before another scene of glowing happiness and stuff takes its place. And you've got these alternating light and dark, light and dark. And then at the end, you know, so it's like, is that an eternal wheel? Or is that at the end of the slideshow, do the lights come up? And the way I looked at it as this is the end of Don's slideshow, and the Coca-Cola commercial is the lights coming up and telling us that it's going to be okay.
Okay.
That he's okay. The fact that Roger tried to tell, I mean, there's a lot of that. That's something that Don was saying, that like advertising is about telling people that you are okay.
I think at the very least he has grown from the place where he believes that love is a fabrication of ad men. Like in that way, it is optimistic to me. He now believes in actual love, and he's willing to give it to this guy who needs it.
Okay.
But yeah, we have gone, Jesus, we have gone on throughout this episode.
Hey, before we get to feedback, just wanted to tell you guys, for perhaps the final time, if you're not going to come back and enjoy the season wrap-up cast with us, about how you can support us at baldmove.com, because we rely on your direct listener support to make ends meet and to continue to create the content that you love and enjoy. There's a couple ways to do that. One is club.baldmove.com. You can go there. It's a great way to eliminate ads from your podcast feed. You get to see us record the podcast in real time and watch some other fun video features. You get access to some behind-the-scenes Bald Move stuff, a VIP forum, a lot of other fun features. And best of all, it's only $1 a month if you support us at the highest level. And that's going to be a value that keeps on getting better. Jim has got some new features in the works, and we're going to be doing some new forms of content this summer that we're excited about. So check out that. Also, if you use Amazon, you can use our link at amazon.baldmove.com instead of the vanilla one, and it'll take you to the site, and anything that you order, we get a cut of for sending you in Jeff Bezos' direction. And it adds up to a lot. So if you're a big fan of Amazon, you're a big fan of Bald Move, put those two great tastes together, amazon.baldmove.com. But again, I really thank you guys for listening over the years. We were gratified last week that we were the number one and two spot on iTunes TV and film rankings. We've experienced so much success, and it's all due to your guys' liking us and rating us and reviewing us and contributing to us and keeping us going. It's been so much fun. Mad Men's one of my favorite television shows, and it's one of my favorite. I think it's also my favorite podcast to do too, because it's the perfect blend of smart commentary from the fans, really funny stuff. It's like the show itself. So it's been really special for me to share this with all of you, and for you guys to share your thoughts and feelings. And we've gotten to talk to so many people from so many different walks of life. That's another thing I've really enjoyed. But if you feel the same way, we could really use your support at club.baldmove.com and amazon.baldmove.com. Feedback from Kevin B said, "Hey guys, others have probably pointed this out, but I just remembered that in season 7, episode 2, A Day's Work, Sally and some school friends are going to the city to attend the funeral of a fellow student's mother. Sally says, I'd stay here until 1975 if it could get Betty in the ground. It's indicative of how we sometimes make often comments about someone dying, but with the events of the last episode, this has become a much, much more real line." Yeah.
Doubt she'd say that now. It's not quite as funny.
No. But there you go. I thought that was good. A lot of people, so many callbacks to previous episodes. Probably get more into this. Again, we're coming back next week for an extravaganza, so If you didn't, I mean, I got crushing amounts of email for both Game of Thrones and Mad Men this week. So, and again, I can only read so much.
Mm-hmm.
But next week, it should be a little bit easier because it's going to be all feedback all the time. Catherine says, Don says in seasons four, The Summer Man, people tell us who we are, but we ignore them because we want to be, we want them to be who we want them to be. The viewers have had all kinds of conspiracy theories about where Don might be going, but the reality is he isn't going to change, and we've known where he is headed all along, exactly where he's already been. We just didn't want to accept it. We wanted there to be something more, but there isn't. Don will quote-unquote die in the middle of a pitch, like Roger suggested. He does this. He'll leave again, learn something, come back, hit another rock bottom, and do it all again and again until he actually dies. That's,
okay, that's
representative of the
taste,
cynical view.
Take for you, yeah.
Jake from Tallahassee says, some iffy moments for me in the finale, but I loved what they did with Joan. For most of the episode, she was joyous and exuberant. Mm-hmm. I initially thought it's because she got hooked on the coke, but I finally realized she's happy after leaving the ad life. No more sexist hierarchical ladders for her to climb. What an incredible journey she has been through, and I'm glad she got a positive send-off. Agreed.
Yeah, I was happy to see Joan happy.
Joseph V., so this is where we're supposed to speculate on whether Tony was whacked and got killed in the restaurant, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
All joking aside, we as individuals would be having a lot of what the hell moments when they see an old Coke ad finalize their time and emotional investment on the show. I am one of those people. I'm sure I wasn't the only one looking at the clock and realized there was only 10 minutes left and Don is still at the Hilltide Cliffside Commune just having his breakdown by the payphone. Can I say that's one of the most annoying things about watching television?
Watching the clock?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I wish I had the ability. It's impossible. It's
Why?
Impossible. Well, because number one, I'm watching on my DVR has a clock. I'm watching
Put
this after the fact
it.
Because I watched, you know, Game of Thrones and did the Game of Thrones coverage.
You're fast forwarding through commercials.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay.
I'm gonna watch commercials like an asshole. Come on.
Yeah. All right. So you see the timer every 10 minutes.
Yeah, but even, yeah, it's like, that's, I never look at my clock in a good movie in a theater, and it's just so annoying to realize that there's only 10 minutes left, and I need to be looking, it's the worst. Yep. Anyway, my ears were buzzing like Sally's last episode, and I couldn't understand or comprehend what was unfolding before me. It takes time, in this case, about a 6-hour sleep to figure out for yourself. I'd like to believe that, like Ginsberg's valve, Don has found a release in meditation and can get over his common trappings of booze, bad women, and running away. I'd like to believe he leaves that commune, goes back to New York like he tells Peggy, takes care of his kids as best as he can given Betty's wishes, and is able to get himself back into McCann to finish out his contract and produce that Coke ad. I don't think a return to advertising cheapens the story. I think it sets Don onto a better path. He could retire if he wants, but I'd rather see him being creative and raising his kids and mentoring them to others than racing at Bonneville and being selfish.
Yeah, I mean, that's
a nice middle road email. A little bit of light, a little bit of dark.
Yeah, you know, he's not going to go back and be a father to his kids necessarily, but
yeah,
he's going to go back and maybe have a little more love in his life from the people around him.
I think it's interesting how little problem I had because, you know, I've been saying for 2 years now, I just want Don to be with his kids. I want Don to be a father to his kids.
Yeah.
And the fact that Wiener didn't give that to me and I was like, yes, sir.
Here's what you really want.
No, I was like, yeah. I just went along with it. That's some good Wienermanship. Evan S. said, episode 12 of season 2, The Mountain King, has Don in another California walkabout. This time he's spending time with Anna Draper. And in one scene, she does a tarot reading for Don. In the middle of the scene, Don randomly comments, I can smell the ocean. Anna comments that she has drawn the world card in a very important spot. When Don asks, what does it mean? Anna replies, it means the only thing keeping you from being happy is the belief that you are alone. Don replies, what if that's true? Anna responds, you can change. And Don says, people don't change. This episode also features Betty Draper giving Sally some riding boots and says, if there's something you want, I want to give it to you. You're getting to be a big girl, and someday you will want something from me, and I won't be able to give it to you. Another thing from this episode, Don meets some guys who are fixing him up hot rods and has a conversation about how he wants to see them race and how fast they can go. Oddly, it links this episode with the finale even more. So if you want to go back and take a look, it's season 2, episode 12, The Mountain King. Sounds like it has a lot of stuff
that
ties into that. especially that the tarot thing with him being alone. So do you think that – I think that's more evidence of the positive ending, that Don knows he's not alone. He's seen a man that has the exact same existential problem as him, and he hugs
yeah,
him.
Yeah, you might be right. Yeah. I mean, I like to think that there's hope for Don having true growth.
Jake from Tallahassee says, as a 90s baby, the earliest Coke ads I'm aware of are the Polar Bear commercials. As you can imagine, I was lost when the final scene hinged on a Coke commercial from the 70s. I'm usually familiar with Mad Men's older pop culture references and song selections, but I had never had seen this Coke commercial. It's bugging me that they chose to use it as the final scene.
Wow. How do you not see this commercial? How do you go through life and not see?
Honestly, I don't think I would have seen it except for the guy, the weird my parents recreating it video. And the fact
I couldn't tell you where I saw it, but I know I've seen it.
I watched
many times.
I know I saw it like back before we had awesome cable. We used to get stuck watching things called like the, you know, best commercials ever made. Oh, like, and there were Super Bowl commercials and all that stuff. And the number one spot was this commercial. And I remember it.
Yeah, I don't know. That seems crazy to me.
Didn't,
you haven't seen
didn't
this.
Coke remake this like 10 years ago? I thought they redid it.
Maybe. Maybe that's why I didn't remember the shitty overhead shot. Could be.
I just remember that one possible, the one girl when she started singing the, it's the real, her face was like improbably broad.
Oh, one thing we didn't talk about is
the end of there?
The similarity in looks between the girl at the desk.
Oh, sure.
At this retreat.
Yeah, with
and the girl
red
in the commercial.
In
yeah.
Yeah. Actually, there's a lot. There's a girl that looks like Stephanie. There's a couple of people in the background that looks like the... There's a...
That, to me, says Don made the commercial, you know?
Yeah, because how would Peggy know all those details?
Yeah.
Don gave them to her?
Why would he describe... And so I need a person in this commercial who looks like this.
Well, you know what? I mean, there's precedent for this with the Teddy... wait, not Teddy Rumsfeld. It is. The guy to wet his pants.
Oh.
Teddy Rumson. Is that his name?
Yeah, yeah. Teddy Rumson.
That Don was doing shadow work for, creative work for. So maybe, like I said, there's you can't dismiss out of hand that this is the
work. Think Don's gonna do shadow work through Peggy?
I mean, I don't think Peggy.
I'm gonna
dismiss
out of hand that this is Peggy.
All right.
Well, I think it's Don.
There you go.
Okay.
Anyway, he says, apparently the commercial is a huge success, but also takes place 20 years before my existence. Instead of a character moment, they ran a 40-year-old commercial that I wasn't familiar with because of age. Is that a legit criticism in your minds?
For you, yes.
I don't think so, because I think if the thing faded to black at Don's smile, you would have the exact same questions about what happens next. The Coke just gives a little bit more context to it.
But it doesn't give any context to him.
Well, but I'm saying it's not necessary. Like I said, I don't think it's necessary. It's extra context.
No, if you're saying, is that a valid criticism? I think it is for you. But for the people who know what the commercial is, I think it hit its mark.
Mad Men's a tough show, man. You got to be incredibly well read, incredibly well watched, and incredibly well versed in pop culture advertising, apparently, to properly enjoy it all.
Or spend hours doing research after every episode.
That too.
That's
or you
possible.
Listen to our podcast. It's a convenient service.
Yeah.
Barry C., where do you rank Mad Men in the hierarchy of golden age television? For me, it's just behind Breaking Bad and The Wire. It has to be the most consistent show I've ever seen. There's never been a really bad episode, in my opinion. Even at its worst, it's compelling and interesting. At the very least, often so much more. I want to have a much larger discussion next week on our wrap-up cast.
Yep, table that.
But I will say, as a spoiler, the best show is different from a favorite show. I think Mad Men is runaway my favorite show ever.
Put a pin in that.
Okay. Pinned. Sean from Massachusetts says, I feel like I may be on an island here, and I was hoping for others feeling the same way in first watch. During the scene with the refrigerator man speech, I found myself closing my eyes as if I was watching some beautiful moment get wasted. I know in retrospect it fit in well and speaks to Don so deeply, but upon my first watch, I was annoyed at how the wiener was wasting these precious last moments of Mad Men with a story from a character I don't know.
It's a story from Don.
Could he have brought Don to the realization in a place he has? He was at with the characters we love and care about rather than the strangers in a foreign place. I feel like upon rewatching, I appreciate the scene more, but it was brutal to endure the first time around, and I'm interested to hear how you both felt. I felt a little bit of that antsy stuff when he started into it, but then, like, within 10, 15 seconds, I saw exactly what they were doing with this.
Yeah, I mean, this is Don.
And when Don got up and hugged him, I thought it was a bravo performance.
Yeah, I suppose when he launched into the speech that he gives, I guess I was getting a little antsy too, but they brought it around.
Okay.
Within a minute and a half, I was over that.
So there you go, Sean. Gabriel L. says, the finale revealed that what we've been watching all along is a story about a man who killed the 60s. The famous Coke ad that Don undoubtedly returns to New York to create represents the final commodification of 60s counterculture. It symbolizes the moment of the old guard appropriated and potentially revolutionary sentiments of the past decade and used them to sell sugar water. This whole time we thought that Mad Men was about the old guard, Don, Roger, etc., struggling to adapt to a world rapidly changing around them. But this episode's final moments reinforce the idea that nothing ever changes, Don least of all. The man that Don hugs doesn't understand what love is and wishes people would choose him the way they choose objects in a refrigerator. Does Don feel guilty for giving so many people this commodified understanding of human relationships? No, he remembers that it's his job as an admin to sell people what love is and that love is Coca-Cola. That's a ballsy commercial, by the way.
Sure.
Like, it's a great commercial, but when you really break it upon it, it's fucking offensive.
And that's a cynical take.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I'm that cynical.
He's just getting warmed up.
Oh, God.
The guru emboldens him to embrace the new you. Both Dick and the 60s are as dead as Don's commanding officer. I'll admit it seriously bums me out to realize that one of my favorite characters ever is basically the greatest villain in TV history, that the song from that Coke ad is going to depress the ever-living shit out of me whenever I hear it from now on. But what a fantastic ending to an amazing show. What do you think? Can you bring yourself to read the finale as cynically as I am? No, I cannot.
No.
But you're not wrong.
You're ascribing the misappropriation of the counterculture of the time to this commercial?
Yeah.
Like, this is the moment where counterculture became irrelevant, that particular counterculture?
Co-opted. Like, I think that's interesting.
And by extension, irrelevant. If it's a tool of big corporations, it is now counterculture.
I don't think it's irrelevant. I think it's subverted. Like, it's a subvert. I mean, it's not. If it's irrelevant, it wouldn't be useful in a commercial. But it's like, you know, it's like essentially... Like Ginsberg, this is another of the greatest hits. I saw Ginsberg screaming at Cutler, like, you know, you're a suit and you're killing babies and doing this. And Cutler comes back with, well, you're cash injected from Don Kimmel. And they had this big, it'd be like ripping Ginsberg's brain out through his nipple and reprogramming him computer style to be a corporate suit. That's essentially what we saw the hippie movement undergoing in this Coke commercial. We are defanging you of all of your dangerous revolutionary ideas, and we are using you to sell a product based on the emotional appeal of your image.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to what's happened to hackers, right?
Elaborate.
Not to sell a product, but they have been demonized. The word has been misappropriated.
Okay. What do you mean?
Hackers are not evil supervillains who break into banks to steal money.
Sure.
They are people who are curious about technology and want to find out how things work.
Yeah.
That has been misappropriated by the government in order to scare people with the word hacker and the idea of what a hacker is.
Yeah. I've read 2600 magazine. I understand it just in a hacker or a cracker. I just never thought it was much. I didn't think it was a very interesting distinction.
It's much more interesting in the 70s than it is today.
All right.
Because it's been so misappropriated. But yeah, it's a similar thing. I don't have the proper context to judge that, though, because I don't know anything about that particular culture in that particular time. I wasn't alive. I don't know how this changed it.
Apparently they're hippies and there's a lot of bullshit. That's what I appreciated.
Well, we know that. That comes with hippies. I'm qualified to judge that.
When Diana L. says, when Don says to her, you can put this behind you, it will be easier as you move forward. When he says this to Stephanie, seriously, I stood up with my bourbon. I like your style, Diana. Yep. And yelled, no, But another Peggy in the hospital, not another Peggy in the hospital room moment. I understand the survival tactic, Don, but just no. And then Stephanie replied, oh, Dick, I don't think you're right about that at all. Yes, yes, Stephanie. I love this slight change, a slight growth, this bit of truth shining through to help Don open the door to achieving his inner peace. Matthew Weiner brought it full circle. So poignant, so powerful, and so satisfying. Going to miss these great moments in time. Let's hope for a Sally Draper spinoff that's as good as Better Call Saul.
Oh, God, no. You want a Sally Draper? Need any Mad Men spinoffs. No, please.
You say no to Peggy and Stan.
The only thing you could do is make it worse. The only thing you could do. You're going to put another 7 years on the screen? That's a scary proposition to me.
I'd get down for Peggy and Stan. I get down for Sally Draper in college.
The Peggy and Stan hour.
I'd be down for a Joan, especially like imagine a dramedy with Joan and Peggy.
No, I can't.
All right, well, fine.
Some things don't just need to come to an end, man.
Don't dream with me, Dan. Yeah, all good things come to an end.
Mad Men is a beautiful thing. Just leave it where it is.
Yep. What is that phrase? All good things must come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
But or else they wouldn't, or something like that.
Oh, I don't know about the last part.
No, there's a phrase about like everything good must come to an end, or else it would never stop. Or I don't know. Fuck. Shit. Let's move on. Distract you with my stupidity with another brilliant email from listeners. Dan from Manchester said, in last week's episode, the old man in the motel rejected getting a new Coke machine because he liked the old one, and Don fixed it for him. And finale, it's possible that Don did the exact opposite. Rejecting fixing himself in favor of returning to his Don Draper persona. He also does this via Coke ad, so the symmetry is even better. Another cynical take on the final message.
And yeah, got a lot of cynics in this
I
crowd.
I can't say Don or Dan is wrong here.
Sure.
Elise K has some historical information, which we're a little light on this episode. I spent more time just watching it and absorbing it than I did researching it. Elise said, I believe the retreat Stephanie and Don go to in Northern California is based on EST, the Erhard Seminars Training, or EST, is an organization founded by Werner H. Erhard, offered a 2-weekend or 60-hour course known officially as the EST Standard Training. The purpose of EST was to transform one's ability to experience living so that situations one had been trying to change or had been putting up with clear up just in the process of life itself. The S training was offered from late 71 to late 1984. The training was attended by a wide cross-section of society, from business professionals to academics, scientists, and celebrities. It's also featured prominently on The Americans.
Yeah.
At this end, when Don is meditating, he's most likely practicing transcendental meditation. This type of meditation is based on the Maharishi. It was popular in the 60s and 70s. I think he's smiling because he's finally at peace in the knowledge that he is alone. I believe that it's a quote from the pilot, "We're born alone, we die alone," and is pitched a lucky strike. Happiness is freedom of fear. Dick is no longer fearful of being caught playing the role of Don Draper.
That's it? That's it. How that email ends? I like it.
It did.
Ends like, it should have ended with a Coke commercial, honestly. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of comparisons, right, to those kind of self-help groups. I've seen another one about this place called...
Scientology?
Esalen? Esalen, it's up in Big Sur, California, and that's kind of exactly where it's situated. It's like over the ocean, and like
Trippell
kind of hippie
used
sort
that
of
terminology in her feedback too. So that's a real thing.
Yeah, and I guess like some of the reviewers were going on about that too. So
it wasn't for her. I just assumed some bullshit you came up with, but no, it is verified yeah. Fact.
I'm on their website, and it says on ancient ground, opening new horizons.
As seen on Mad Men?
Not that I'm seeing.
All right, I'm back to thinking it's bullshit. Justin F., while it's not the best Mad Men episode ever, it'd be funny if people debated whether the ending of the Mad Men Happy Hour podcast was cynical or optimistic.
Well, we'll just play a Coke commercial on our way out.
There you go. Monster Truck commercial would be more appropriate.
There you go.
I
like that.
Okay. While it's not the best Mad Men episode ever, and it's not the best season finale ever, it's our last glimpse into the lives of beloved characters and will be fondly remembered by me. I'm glad Pete got this happy ending because despite being a despicable person, he has grown and matured. Mm-hmm. It felt true because in real life, terrible people don't always get their comeuppance, and sometimes they get a second chance. I'm glad Roger found what makes him happy, a snarky, shit-talking, take-no-nonsense woman who won't make, who won't take care of him, but with whom he can finally be himself. But most of all, I'm glad that the Peggy and Stan ship has officially sailed. God, who can say no to that lion's mane? I wish we'd have had more time with Betty and especially more time with Sally, but we've left them in a better place than I could have ever imagined, comfortable with each other and ready to face the future together as mother and daughter. I thought I hated Betty for years, and it wasn't until this last half season that I realized that I actually really like her. She is damaged, childish, petty, and vindictive. She's all these things because of the life thrust upon her. She was an Italian-speaking model who settled into the role of beautiful mother and homemaker only to discover that there was no fulfillment in being little more than a trophy, an accessory to Don's life that he pulls out when he wants to show off and puts away when he's bored. I can't imagine how horrible it must be to have your dream inverted into a nightmare and what that can do to one's psyche. Betty is a tragic and flawed figure, but stoic and stronger than we could possibly have guessed when we first met her.
I agree with that in a lot of ways.
Shockingly, I do too.
The one thing I disagree with is that you loved Betty all along. Betty has changed.
I don't think did he say that?
Yeah, he came to realize that he actually loved Betty. I think that wasn't a realization of you've always loved Betty.
Oh, I don't think he was saying that.
Betty has changed so much that I now love her.
Okay, that's a fair point. Yeah. That's a fair point. And I turned a 180 on her last episode. I mean, there's nothing like dying of cancer with dignity and grace to make you like a person.
Sure, and step back and assess your life and those sorts of things. Yeah, and I agree with you. I came around on Betty at the end too. So,
all right, here's another depressing take, Mike C. I think the conclusion is sad and depressing for Don. He sank to rock bottom, lost pretty much everything, and seemed on the verge of ending it all during his call with Peggy. Mm-hmm. But then something happened with the refrigerator dude. He had a type of breakthrough, a realization, and a seemingly found enlightenment. I don't understand how, but Don somehow clawed his way back from a bottomless pit of despair. So he could start over doing the same thing again on a larger scale? I guess it's a fitting end because it was a common refrain from Dick that he loves beginning of things. Peggy even told him, "I know how you get sick of things." I can't help but feel sad for him, though, because I don't think there was any real enlightenment or understanding. The retreat and his new age experiences were just another tool that Don used to start over. By going back to McCann to make the Coke commercial, he's jumping back into a world that is created or based on creating false perceptions of reality and commoditizing feelings and emotion. That's why the ending with Coke is so meaningful. Coke's slogan may very well be "It's the real thing," but there is nothing real about the Coke jingle.
Including the ingredients. Oh, wait.
Yeah, it doesn't have cocaine in it.
No.
God damn it.
Misnomer at the best.
Richard took it all down to Key West with him. Like cigarettes in the beginning of the show, Coke is a classic example of a product no one needs that is made by a company that is willing to spend huge amounts of money to convince people otherwise. That takes real talent and creativity. And who better than the new and improved Don Draper to convince everyone to drink Coke by tying sugar water to love, happiness, acceptance, and harmony.
Yeah, that's kind of how I read it.
Dude, I need Coke because I don't drink coffee. And that this empire flows on alcohol and also caffeine. Those are the two pillars of the Bald Move Empire and listener support.
But, sure.
What do you think about that?
I'm pretty much on board with that take. Like, I definitely have a more skeptical take than you. I think that's a solid argument as far as, like, the commoditizing of love, you know?
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree.
Yeah.
Eric Wahlquist, our buddy from the
the
defunct Personal Arrogance podcast that we destroyed in open podcast combat.
We really did crush them.
We co-opted them and destroyed them from within. So there's your depressing, cynical take. Anyway, Eric says, "I found the final scene in the seminar very poignant. The message from the square dude in the sweater was incredibly moving, not only because it completely embodied what Don was feeling, but because I think it paints a vibrant picture of how a lot of people feel today. At least I feel that way sometimes, constantly seeking some kind of approval that I can't even identify. And when we find artificial ways to fill that void, like substances, sports, getting likes on Facebook, in this digital world where everyone is at your fingertips, everything and everyone is at your fingertips, many times it feels even lonelier than ever. In fact, the square's message was so spot on with Don that it spawned the fan theory in my own brain. My wife was taken aback when she saw Don hugging another man and crying. In retrospect, it did seem a touch out of character, even at that emotional time. That got me thinking about the square dude and how it might actually have been Don, or Dick at least, in an out-of-body experience. The moment where he got up and hugged the man was the moment that Don was able to forgive himself for everything he had done and learn to love himself so that he could allow other people to love him. Then he went and sold sugar water to children.
Wait, is that skeptical or not? Man, he twisted it up there at the end.
It's the personal arrogance way.
That's true.
So I actually think that's kind of cool because there was this thing where the female therapist kind of looked at him expectantly and he kind of, I felt like, was on the verge of getting up and opening up, and then the man started speaking.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So like, I'm not saying there's any evidence, although who knows in the months and years to come this how well this thing will be dissected and all that stuff. I mean, there'll be a 15-minute YouTube video that solves all this stuff.
Yeah, 50-page blog article.
But for fan, you know, headcanon, that's not bad. That literally was Don, a Dick Whitman, like a shriveled Dick Whitman version of Don, and that he literally engaged in self-love, not in the sense of the word, but in the,
that's, you know, self-abuse.
It's true. Aaron. That's true.
Yeah.
Does self-abuse feel honest?
Does while I'm doing it.
Then it feels shameful and gross, and you can't shut that tab fast enough. What did I just get off to?
Oh, my God.
This week has been surprisingly
about
a lot of Don hugging other dudes, honestly. It's been getting it done for me.
All right.
What? What are we talking about?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of along the lines of what I said earlier, you know, with him being that man being Don. But I guess if he's Dick Whitman, then that's a proto-Don. It's a version of Don that maybe could accept some love, maybe needs the love more.
Mm. All right. Dan from London. We got two more takes. Dan from London says, firstly, I hated it. Then I was kind of indifferent. And at the moment, I think I really liked it, referring to the season. Don has spent the last part of the season shedding his Donness and returning to be Dick. Each episode, he moved closer to Dick.
Wait.
You know, I've been able to break the Dick penis barrier, but somehow the homoeroticism of my last comment is connected it. And now,
shame on you.
Loving Dick and moving closer to Dick is got me giggling. God damn it.
For shame.
All right, I'm trying to find my center. All right. Don has spent the last part of the season shedding his Donis and returning to Dick. Each episode he moved closer to Dick, but there's clearly an ongoing internal struggle between the two. For me, the commune in California is a substitute for the car crushing site in Superman 3, where good and bad Superman battle it out for supremacy. Ah. And who better to oversee this battle than Supergirl herself? Did you know the female therapist played Supergirl in the really shitty 1980s adaptation called Supergirl?
I had no idea.
It's bad. It's really bad. That's one
I
of
feel
my,
like I've seen that, but I don't remember.
Like the Star Wars holiday special and that piece of shit was one of my like first memories of being bitterly disappointed in something. Dick is the fridge man. Don is the man who helps fridge man feel better about themselves, and he sells them Coke on the back of it. With Don having won the battle of survival, you only have to see him sit on the hilltop to know who is the victor. The red or the white shirt and the clean shaven face give it away. Don Draper's back. The chime represents an almost cartoon-like idea going off in his head, and where the smile at the end of the penultimate episode was a Dick Whitman smile, our final look in the smile of the man before us after this person-to-person battle is most certainly Don Draper's.
Hmm.
Evil Superman won, man.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
All right, well, again, you're not wrong, except for in the way that's inside my head, but
okay.
In other ways, it's a completely defensible argument. Lisa LL Trippel, our senior black correspondent. Maybe the final email, maybe signing off for the final time. We'll see.
We got a wrap up cast.
The finale was not bad, but definitely was not worthy of the 7 seasons that preceded it. I don't have a problem with what happened. I have a problem with how it was executed. Firstly, the Don. I think the key to Don's dysfunction was in season 2, the Mountain King. Another Mountain King reference. We talked about this. The only thing from keeping you from being happy is the belief that you are alone. After retreat, Don hears Leonard's story of being unable to recognize and receive love, realizes he's not alone, and finally finds happiness as a result. When I watched the hug between Leonard and Don, I kind of cringed because it seemed false. John Hamm and Evan Arnold playing Leonard were excellent, so it wasn't the acting. The problem was in the writing. Springing new characters and new age mumbo jumble on us in the finale episode and then having someone we've never seen before articulates Don's deepest fear within 10 minutes left the series disconnected. Me from the Don that I've spent 7 seasons watching. How powerful would it have been for Don to have had his Did you call it Esalen?
I think so, yeah.
That his Esalen retreat realization from something Peggy said. Very. Speaking of Peggy, I love Peggy. Hmm. I love Stan. I love Peggy and Stan. I cheered the rom-commy way they realized they loved each other, but just didn't feel like Mad Men. I would have rather had the Wiener show us Peggy and Stan realizing they were in love rather than having us tell us that they were in love.
I felt like they did realize it while they were on the phone.
Yeah, I mean, I see what she's saying, though. That was a very fine line to walk that the Wiener just blew me away with a fire hose of Peggy Stan love. Yeah, what was I to do? What was I to do, Walter?
Sure. To the other point, though, about this refrigerator guy, I think she might be right. Having a complete stranger identify the problems with Don and having Don recognize them in a complete stranger may not have been quite as poignant as if
really you don't think someone this is else... like a, maybe this says more about me than Refrigerator Man, but don't you think that's a universal? That's the whole point. Like
it's
everyone
showing you
feels
that everyone
like,
feels like that. Not
everyone
just the
that is above average a level of intelligence feels like they're a fuck up from time to time, and they're worthless and they've messed it up. That's like to me. I see so many highly functioning people brought down by their own sense of perfectionism and shame over bullshit. And it's a continual downward spiral. And that's epitomizes Don, where if you can just get that's kind of what I said about the whole, you know, going back to Jesse and Breaking Bad and his experience in group therapy. It's like sometimes you have to get over a lot, but if you can get over that and love yourself and forgive yourself, then you can reset and be back to, you know,
so you just don't
highly functioning.
You don't think it has the same effect if someone he knows says it because he doesn't identify with that concept of everyone feeling like this or
see,
he doesn't see it outside of his own experience at that point. Or
here's what I would say. People that know Don Draper see this magnificently impressive person.
Yeah.
And their first instinct when he tells them he has a problem is to deny it has an exist. Look at Peggy. Mm-hmm. That's not true. What did you do that was so bad? Whereas this stranger can just say what he's feeling in his heart and connect in a way because he's not trying to tell Don Draper he's okay. He's trying to say, I feel really fucked up. And sometimes, I mean, that's the whole point of group therapy. I think more than half of group therapy is for you to be there and hear people more fucked up than you and think,
what if you're
I'm
the
not,
most fucked up person in the room?
That's what I was going to say. The dark side of that is there may be, but it's also in your point of view, like what your hell might be another man's paradise,
sure,
you know?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So like, you know, maybe I often wonder like the therapists don't engineer the rosters of support groups. I mean, I know there's some like you just kind of take whoever comes off the street, but there's others that it's more structured. And I wonder if they don't.
That's not a bad point.
Yeah.
He just might not have accepted it coming from someone else. May not have been able to give him the advice or the story.
Yeah,
he
most people just blow Don off. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, you're so rich and you're fantastically good looking, and you lay beautiful women, and you have this interesting career, and you can do whatever you want. They see all the good things about Don. They don't see any of the negative.
That's
bad
what
Mathis things.
Says, you know, a few episodes ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Mathis comes in when he gets fired and is like, oh, poor Don. Poor Don. He's handsome and rich and charismatic. Yeah. You might be right.
Yeah, no, rich, attractive, white, straight guys get really crushingly depressed too. Even when
you're
at the top of
happens.
The pile. Like, but everybody else is like, boo fucking who?
Yeah.
I don't know. It felt very genuine for that moment to come from a stranger from me.
Sure. Nobody cares that Donald Trump gets depressed about his hair.
Well, Donald Trump's a total fucking asshole too. With zero class, zero style.
Exactly my point. Exactly.
Jump off a cliff, Donald. Please.
All right. That's it.
If you'd like to give us feedback for our spectacular, which
you're billing this pretty highly.
Well, no, it's our regular shtick that we do. Okay. That's kind of what I do. But also, I've got this wild idea that you've kind of signed off on that I want to rewatch an episode of Mad Men once per month over the next
No, no, no. You want to rewatch a season?
Oh yes. Of Mad Men. Sorry, a whole season month, month that would for take month.
Ages.
It's going to wrap us up around Christmas time, and like you know, even the seasons that we've covered, and instead of you know, because a lot of people are like, hey, can you do the Breaking Bad treatment and do an episode? I don't think we're ever going to do that.
So much back catalog.
So much back catalog. And just with the nature of what we're doing with the current stuff, I don't think it's going to happen, but I personally like Mad Men enough that I want to do this kind of like season and try to especially mine the nuggets that seem to be relevant in retrospect and chart the important moments. And were we too hard on Pete? Were we too hard on Betty? Is Peggy secretly a worse person than we think? Like I want to explore some of those issues and spend an hour or so talking about each season. I will definitely, you know, come up with a release schedule in advance, but that's kind of something I want to flesh out and maybe have a little bit more concrete plans on for the extravaganza. But I'd like to hear your thoughts about where it stacks up for you personally in the golden age of television. I'd like to hear favorite episodes, favorite characters, favorite moments, like all the just let's just get nostalgia.
Retrospect, man.
From the Greek word meaning anal pain. Let's all get nostalgic together. And
not certain that that's true, but I'm not certain it's not.
So. There you go. You've got no proof either way.
No.
Are you cynical or are you an optimist? So we want to get nostalgic. We want to ride the carousel one more time. That's next week. And then I'll have talk about plans for our season by season coverage. Because I think that's a good place to leave the feed. You have a nice retrospective of all seven seasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to give people that find Mad Men in our podcast in the future a nice little place to land.
I think so.
All right. Any last words before we sign off?
No. I mean, we'll be back next week, of course, with the wrap-up.
MadMen@baldmove.com if you got the thoughts. Forums.baldmove.com if you want to discuss it with me or Jim and your fellow fans. Keep up with our releases on Facebook.com/baldmove and on Twitter @baldmove.
All of that.
Baldmove.com, as always.
Yep. And we'll see you guys next week.
Yep.
We'll be right back.